It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
On May Day, there were rallies held across the country, with many of them singling out President Trump's Get Tough policy on undocumented immigrants. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. From New York to California, marchers made their displeasure known. The Washington Post found Immigration and Customs Enforcement arrested some 21,000 immigrants since Trump took office. That's up about 32.6%. Deportations, though, were down slightly by 1.2% because of legal and bureaucratic issues. At the border, there's been a dramatic drop in apprehensions from more than 40,000 per month last year to just over 12,000 in March. Meanwhile, the president has said that those who come under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA, should rest easy. I want to take a look at the impact this is having on the community. In our studios this morning, we have Pastor Greg Knepp. He's with the St. Peter's Lutheran Church. Also, immigration specialist Layla Barrero Kraus, also with CATA, a workers' rights organization. Professor Tim Dunn, he's with the Salisbury University, and Veronica Martinez, former student, actually, of the professor, and comes under the DACA program. And welcome to you all.
Thank you.
So, Layla, I want to start with you. What is the sense that you have, you're out there in the community working with them, trying to figure out how to deal with this changing landscape? We still don't really know exactly how it's all going to play out yet. What are you hearing from the community?
Good morning. Yes, I hear from many of our community members of the fear of being stopped by officers, ICE or police, local police. They're concerned about their children's future. They're concerned about their benefits that they get for their children will be stopped, even they are U.S. citizen. Their concerns about coming out in public or coming out to public areas and enjoy the freedom that they used to enjoy.
Go ahead.
We have been conducting outreach to several churches throughout the community on Sundays after the religious events, and trying to bring some ease of mind to some of those community, especially because the bullying that the kids are getting subject to, and their fear to come out to grocery stores, even to their church services.
So one of the things I ran across when I was up in Georgetown earlier this week talking to some undocumented folks is that there were a number in which, for instance, they had children who were American citizens. And so we asked, we said, well, okay, what happens if you're deported? What happens to children? And they said, well, the children will just have to come with us because there's no place for them here. You find that to be the case where you have these mixed families?
Yes. It is a lot of confusion with that because the children are U.S. citizens and they're entitled to come and go as they please. And if their parents choose to take them with them, they have definitely that choice. They can register with the embassies and get the dual citizenship. So when they go to their country, they have as much benefits as, you know, they were born there. And at the age of 18, they decide to come back to the United States. They're still entitled to that. It is a lot of things that they need to do to obtain that dual citizenship. And they, a lot of times it takes travel to Washington, D.C. to obtain the proper documentation for the children. Mexican Embassy has been fabulous coming to the Eastern Shore to provide some of the services. They can take their kids or choose to leave them here with a family member or trust friend. A lot of times they think social services or the government is going to take those children away from them. We try to clear their mind and ease their spirit because they think those kids will be put for adoption. They will lose their children. And it's not necessarily so. I try to explain to them the only time the social services or the court system will get engaged with them is if they are mistreated or they are somehow malnutritious, or they're not attending school or something like that.
So it's one of the things, too, is I saw that there was a report that a lot of the police departments are now seeing less Hispanic women coming to report domestic violence, and less, for instance, and if there are ICE raids, for instance, particularly near schools, suddenly the attendance drops. Is that that's general sense that you get there by the community?
Yeah, I have seen some of that. And then we have over here a very active advocate for domestic violence. And we have tried to encourage the families to stop the domestic violence, to have a more positive presence in our community.
So I'm going to turn to Veronica. You come under DACA. Let me first ask you, when you heard that program was in place a number of years back, what was your reaction?
Oh, it was a relief. It was a very exciting moment to know that we were getting that program. But I was also realizing that it was more than anything, it wasn't the solution. It was just kind of a placeholder. And that's what also a lot of DACA students are feeling right now. They're feeling the fear that placeholder is going to go away. I mean, he has said that should rest easy, but there's still that fear that it's going to be taken away soon. And there's fear also in that community because a lot of kids are aging in, 15 years old. They qualify to apply for DACA if they turn 15 years old. But they are, because of that fear that has been going around the country, a lot of people are not taking advantage of it, even though it's still in place. And so I don't know, I have mixed emotions, really. I was really grateful for it to come about. Back in 2012, I was able to work in different places with a legal work permit. I was able to finish school, but now I'm still just being realistic and also cautious that because it may be taken away. So I'm just trying to do what I can in the meantime. I have it until 2018, and we don't know if it's going to maintain or not.
Let me say, is it affected this atmosphere and this uncertainty? Has it affected the way you carry out your daily life? Are you more cautious? Are you? Because I know I've read some reports where some folks who came out of the DACA nonetheless got arrested and at least are facing deportation.
Yes, it has, especially with the news that also I don't know if you've seen it, but there was a dreamer who was deported within hours. Within 3 hours, he was deported, even though he had DACA. And that's also a bit concerning, you know, because we have our permits, but we don't have it with us all the time. It's just not something that we should be doing. But even then, that also tells us that even if we have it, we might still be under deportation. We might still get deported. Hmm. So it's a little bit of concerning, yes.
Layla, because one of the things I ran across is that that you don't have to be a criminal in order to get deported. I mean, if they have traffic violations, that kind of thing. What kind of experience are you? And if you have any examples of it, but people who face that kind of thing.
People who are stopped because they don't have a driver's license, they have no criminal background, but they need to go to the grocery store. They need to take the families to church. They need to take it to the medical appointments. They need to take them to school. And if they don't have a driver's license, they get stopped for any little, they change a lane without turn signal, something like that. It could be a case where police can stop them. There's also where they're working and ICE can come and get them at work, and they do an ICE raid. They don't have criminal records, but they're working because they're working undocumented. That is an act that the ICE will look into very hard.
So, Veronica, what? Where do you come from, by the way? What country?
I'm from Mexico.
From Mexico. So what would it mean if you were deported to Mexico? If they said you can't stay anymore, What do they mean in terms of your own personal life? What would that mean in terms of your family? I mean, because I've talked to a number of folks who come into DACA, and that's one of the big issues that they face is that their parents might be undocumented, and it's like their whole lives will be then shifted out.
Yeah, I have been in this country for 13 years now. I am in the in-between place because I was 10 years old when I came here, and I have been here for more than half of my life here. But my family is a very mixed-status family, so I know that if I get deported, then that's probably going to go alone. But my family, my siblings, my nieces and nephews are here. Their life is here. This is where it is. So I would be separated personally from the rest of my family. But I also have my mom who's in Mexico. So I would be with her. That's a good thing. I would like for her to come over here with us, but right now she cannot. But it's just, again, I don't know where my life would take me if I were deported. I know that I would have to start over once I can go to Mexico because I have been part of this country now for 13 years.
I don't want to say culture shock, but what kind? I mean, I've talked to one of the DACA folks who said that again, like you, basically grown up here. And I think he came in, I think, when he was only like 8 months old, so he doesn't remember things at all. But that he would go back. He's visited Mexico, and that there's this gulf between his experiences in this country and their experiences.
Yeah.
I mean, do you find that to be the case? I mean, do you think that would happen? I mean, how do you think you would assimilate, I guess, for lack of a better word?
I think it would be difficult, especially since my Spanish is not as good as it used to be. But I'm also realizing that we started from the bottom when we got here, so it's possible. That's also to start on there. I mean, I wouldn't want to, but if that's unfortunately the case, then that's also what's going to happen.
By the way, do you remember how did you come across? How did you come here? Do you remember that? I mean, what was that like?
It was a difficult time to come. Yes, across the border when I was 10 years old. So it's just a memory that I try to repress sometimes.
I mean, I understand
because of the border patrol.
Sure, yeah. Tim, I want to turn to you. So what are the demographics in all of this? I mean, and particularly for here on the Lower Shore. I mean, there's a lot of attention being paid certainly to Delaware, where there's a larger Hispanic population, but they seem to be fairly well organized, lots of organizations and so on. What does it look like in terms of those folks who are dealing with that as opposed to what we're looking at here in the Lower Shore?
Delaware has a longer history of kind of service provision to immigrant community and a larger kind of concentrated presence of immigrants working particularly in the poultry industry in southern Delaware and many poultry plants. And Georgetown has been a real center where, you know, half the town is now Hispanic and it's almost all of that is immigrant. Much of that is Central American, most of it. And Central Americans have had better chances to apply for legal protection of some kind, to apply for a political asylum. And a few cases, Hondurans and Salvadorans have been able to get temporary protected status as well. Due to natural disasters in their home countries and so on. So there have been a few more legal options for people there to at least apply for. And then pending, you know, case delays are pretty long. They can, you know, live their lives in the meantime. Religious groups really help band together. Multiple interfaith groups came together to help provide legal assistance, language assistance, prenatal health care, kind of enrollment and nutrition programs and so on. And really develop a nice network of services there for an immigrant community that's very large relative to the local population. Here, our local, you know, native population is much larger. Salisbury is a much larger town than any of the towns in southern Delaware, apart from, you know, Dover and central Delaware. And the immigrant presence is more dispersed here. It's not so concentrated. But the overall numbers here are larger. But it's just people don't look like it because our total population is larger here. And people live in more dispersed areas. They're not so concentrated in specific neighborhoods as much, although there are a few. And we really haven't had any immigrant assistance center kind of pop up here. And, you know, you're looking at the immigrant community here also is more diverse. There's a lot more Haitian immigrants here, as well as various Latino immigrants, mainly Mexican, but also some Central Americans. And we have a large Korean community. We have a large number of South Asian people from India and Pakistan here. The Asian immigrants tend to come more overwhelmingly with visas and with higher education and working in professional occupations quite often, or in entrepreneurial activities. Often coming with college educations really makes the adjustment process much easier, but still, with challenges. And then the Latino immigrants and Haitian immigrants are more lower income. Many lack visas. Haitians have had some opportunity to get visas, but Latinos less so. And so you got that legal status obstacle there. And language barriers are larger as well for the group, and educational levels lower. So it's more challenging. And we just don't have a service provision center here. A migrant clinicians network and Layla's group, Kata, and others have been working to do these outreach sessions to help prepare people in the event of deportation and family separation and so on. And really have realized the lack of services here. We need to establish something along those lines here. The foreign-born population in the three lower shore counties has about doubled since 2000. It's still fairly small, between 5 and 8% in the three lower shore counties, but it has doubled. And in 1990, the percentages were like 1%. So, it's been a slow but a fairly sizable increase, but it's still a fairly small overall. And there's a lot of adjustment issues that go along with it, and a great many mixed status households, which you've kind of been focusing on, of people with visas, people with legal, with citizenship, and undocumented household members. And it creates a great deal of tension and fear in the household if one family member is undocumented.
Why do you think it is that the Lower Shore doesn't have as many services? Is it just simply because they're not concentrated, or is there an organizational issue in the sense that the Hispanic community, at least on the Lower Shore, is not as well organized as, say, for instance? Or I see Layla smiling, too, so she can jump in too as well.
The Easton has established a multicultural resource center there that it really does work a lot with the immigrant community. Part of it is that the immigrant community is, again, a bit more concentrated there, more visible and obvious. But a lot of it is funding, and we just haven't had the local kind of, nonprofit organizations and religious faith-based community folks come together to put something like that together. That's the model that's been the case in many other communities across the country. It just hasn't coalesced here in the same way. For all the factors you mentioned, but we're kind of heading in that direction as we go through this sort of crisis period here. I think it's becoming more obvious that we need to do something like that. When we did a needs assessment survey over a decade ago of Spanish-speaking immigrants on the Eastern Shore for the local library association, they wanted to be able to serve people better. Found that the biggest problems people faced were language barriers, transportation difficulties, immigration papers, work problems, and crime issues. And the biggest thing people wanted was English classes. And secondly, they wanted help with transportation and then likewise immigration issues and papers and work help, to resolve work issues. And, those are the kind of services that people need that many other community centers around the country kind of put together something that can provide some of those.
You were smiling there a moment ago. How is the community responding to what you see as the needs of this particular community? Is it getting any easier? Are people more understanding, or are they less understanding given the atmosphere we're experiencing? What's your sense about that? I mean, are they responding, you think?
I think they have got used to the system in the area, and they stay quiet. They do not want to rock the boat. They keep quiet about employment issues, discrimination, mistreatment, because they want to continue working. So they do not want to create any more gravity to what is going on in the political arena with families being disrupted. And they are survivors. They try to do the best they can without complaining. They have to support themselves. here and many times families abroad. So their main issue is work, work, work. And even if they're not being paid overtime or what they're supposed to be, and they're being threatened sometimes with, I'm going to call ICE, if you complain or if you have a workers' compensation case, they are afraid to come forward because they want to continue working and earn their living. That's the main focus, to provide for their families.
Pastor Knepp, your church, and you've been involved with trying to get assistance. What are you folks doing, and how did you get involved with this?
Well, I was asked by our local Lutheran bishop to coordinate an effort to mobilize congregations throughout Delaware and Maryland, because historically the role of caring for immigrants, for foreigners, for refugees has been a very strong one within the faith community. In fact, there are over 100 verses in Scripture that specifically call us to care for the stranger and for the foreigner. And so education is a big piece of it, because as Layla has just mentioned, for many of the immigrants themselves, they are living in a culture of fear right now. And that has certainly increased during the last year or so. And so part of our role, I see, in the church community is to help people become more understanding and aware of the true issues that immigrants face in the community. And so part of the role is education. Part of the role is reaching out and providing direct assistance to families if they do indeed come under a difficult moment where someone is in danger of being deported. An issue here locally is the fact that the Worcester County Jail in Snow Hill has 170 beds that are cells that are specifically contracted for detainees. And so we are putting together a program to visit, because a lot of times family members are afraid to go and visit the folks who are detained there, and also providing transportation. We were just involved with a case 2 weeks ago from Baltimore where someone was detained. They were brought to Snow Hill. They expect the father to be deported. The son is suffering in the last stages of leukemia. And so we tried to make arrangements to bring the son essentially for his last visit, to be able to say goodbye to his father before he was deported. And so to be able to help people understand that this is a real issue that touches people's hearts and lives in a political environment, which has frankly become just very nasty recently.
How do you, because you're out there, and what do your members say? Are there any members that say, gee, I'm not sure we should be involved with this? Or what's the sense that you get about the community?
Yes, our membership is a spectrum, just as you would find in society. There are some who are very, very supportive and are actively engaged and involved. And there are others who, I think, kind of roll their eyes and say, Pastor, can't you just stay away from that? But the answer is no. We have, as a denomination, and in fact, across the spectrum, the faith community is more united on this issue of serving immigrants and refugees than almost any other political issue that one might encounter, because Scripture is so replete with these very specific directives to assist our neighbor, to assist the foreigner. And we're not given the option of asking where they come from. That's not part of the option. We are called as people of faith to reach out and to help. And so that's the message that we kind of keep bringing.
In terms of the political establishment, because this is a very conservative area. I mean,
yes.
Matter of fact, I think there's only one A couple of Democrats left in the state legislature from here.
Right. And,
what is a political? How does that political atmosphere reach you? I mean, what kind of reaction do you get from them? Because they have to attend to the feelings of their constituents, and many of whom, conservative, and say, "Take well, no, I'm sure would say deport them all. Others would say they broke the law, for example. If nothing else, they take a much less sympathetic line to it. What kind of relationship do you find there?
Well, you're absolutely right. This is that's where, you know, fortunately for us, when the faith community approaches an issue from a moral basis, you know, trying to implement policies and advocate for policies that are more positive for immigrants and refugees, it's a difficult one. But you know, on the other hand, political leaders often want to show that they are, in fact, people of faith themselves. That's how many of them got elected, and so in a way, it becomes an opportunity, one might say, to challenge those leaders. That if you're going to take a moral stand on issue X over here, well, here's what your denomination, your faith community, says about immigrants and refugees. You know, we expect you to also act in a way that drives your faith on this issue as well.
Do you find many of them respond to that?
There are some who do, but then there are others, as you might imagine, who are able to then use another line of argument and say, well, you know, most of my constituents say this. And so part of what we really have to do is let people know that there are so many misperceptions that are being spread, so many downright lies that are being offered right now coming out of the White House and other places. And we need to constantly combat that with real stories and true facts about the immigrant community and how much they contribute. How much they contribute economically and socially to our environment.
Well, we've been speaking with Pastor Greg Knepp. He's with the St. Peter's Lutheran Church, also immigration specialist. Leila Barrell-Krauss also works with CATA, a workers' rights organization. Professor Tim Dunn here at Salisbury University, as well as Veronica Martinez, a former student of the professor, also comes under the DACA program. And we wish you, by the way, Veronica, all the best. And appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Stephanie Fallon.
And this is Tony Russo.
And this week on So What's Your Story, we're going to be talking with Vicki Mullaney. She is the chef and lodge manager for The Lodge at Black Pearl, and she's got a great cookbook out now. So we're going to be talking with her about that.
Join us Saturdays, 1 p.m., following This American Life on WSDL, Rhythm and News. Stephanie never says Rhythm and News.
Still not doing it.
A couple of weeks ago on the Easter edition of Vintage Country with me, Tom Pittman, we gave you all gospel music for the whole show. This week we're going to give the devil his due and do all songs about the devil. That's on Vintage Country here on WSDL.
Hi, I'm Chris Heim, inviting you to join me in the Global Village for the best in music from around the globe. Each week, we journey around the world for the most compelling new releases, rare and classic recordings, birthday spotlights, and other features and specials, along with a surprising array of artists from almost every style imaginable who incorporate international sounds into their work. That's all in the Global Village, Saturdays at 4, here on WSDL 90.7 FM.
The 2016 presidential campaign saw a sharp divide in the ranks of the Democratic Party, and it's still being played out, even as Democrats appear to be united against the man in the White House. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. There is no doubt that the Democrats are watching with glee as the presidency of Donald Trump hits one speed bump after another.
But what is their future? In the 1990s, the New Democrat came onto the scene with the presidency of Bill Clinton that moved away from the more traditional liberal wing of the party. For the 2016 presidential race, a new trend has emerged under what may be described as the Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party. Dean, we saw this play out in the battle over the chairmanship of the party, with former Labor Secretary Tom Perez seen as a more established figure, beating out Representative Keith Ellison. Ellison has been, though, brought on as a deputy chair to unite the party. So where do progressives go? What will be their impact? In our studios this morning, we have Professor Michael Laughlin. He's a political science professor at the East Salisbury University. Also, Michael Feldman. He's chair of the Lower Shore Progressive Caucus. And Jared Schablein. He is also chair and candidate recruitment and education and training committee member of that as well. And we appreciate you all stopping by and chatting with us here this morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
So we, of course, have the health care bill, I guess, that got passed in the House. And the Democrats, at least all the Democrats on the floor, seem to be saying that basically that the Republicans are going to be paying for this down the road here in 2018. So, I mean, one of the questions becomes for progressives, and Mike, I'm going to start with you. I've talked to a number of progressives during the campaign, and they were all very disenchanted with Hillary Clinton. Clinton, of course, then ultimately lost. Some of them decided they would vote for third-party candidates or not support Clinton at all. So one of the questions I have is, wouldn't it be better if you were, say, dealing and fighting with Hillary Clinton in the White House over health care, who is a traditional Democrat, as opposed to, say, somebody like Trump? Is there a practical side to progressive politics here?
I think so. I would absolutely agree with you. Working with any Democrat or anyone who shares the vast majority of our values is really going to be more practical than staying at home. But unfortunately, when it comes to Democrats, liberals, and progressives, the difference between them and some other voters is you have to earn their vote. You have to convince them that you are for them. And you have to do that not only in your rhetoric, but also your policies. And I think for a long time, we've seen the Democrats moving away from that a little bit. And that's why you see the lack of enthusiasm. And that's why you see people staying home as opposed to coming out to vote.
What issues do you think resonated with, say, the Bernie Sanders or the progressive folks, and say during the election, that just said, "Oh, I can't cross the line."
I think the biggest thing for me personally was, once again, it seemed to be a lack of authenticity. It seemed like Hillary Clinton needed to be pushed from $12 an hour to $15. The Wall Street speeches that came out—it's really an idea that the Democratic Party needs to go back to being a party for the working class. And at least the perception is that they are very much controlled to a point by their larger donors, corporate interests, special interests, and things of that nature.
Jared, what about you? What about is politics practical or is it idealistic?
Progressive politics are practical. It would have been a lot easier to work with Hillary Clinton in the White House. The thing about the whole pitting the progressives against the other wing of the party is just more of a push to distance ourselves. We do have a lot of areas where we could work with a Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump, but as Michael said, she did need to be pushed. Some of the things she said didn't seem authentic. I mean, there was periods in her life, like, for example, with something like gay marriage, where she was against it, and they came forward when you had the Senator Sanders, who has been pushing for it for the last 40 years. So would it have been a lot easier to get a single-payer healthcare system through with a Hillary Clinton? Yes, it would. I would have to say the only silver lining about Donald Trump is people are finally waking up. They're getting involved in the political process. They're beginning to realize, hey, this matters. We need to focus on this. And you're seeing with the Republican health care plan that the people are waking up. They're realizing, hey, they're coming after us. We need to get involved. We need to take a stand. So both arguments have pros and cons to them. What happened happened. Donald Trump is our president, so we have to move forward for that, and that includes working with the other wing of the party to get things done.
Because obviously, I mean, moving beyond just simply the presidential election, I mean, you have a bunch of candidates who are certainly running for the 2018, and I'm reminded of a president who once had constituents, who particularly, I think they were on the left, who said, "We want you to do all these things," and he said, "Oh, this is really great. That's great. Now make me do it."
That is that just because somebody's elected doesn't necessarily mean they're going to have the political capital or necessarily the political will to make something happen. That the grassroots and the organization have to make that happen, as opposed to, say, for instance, having a candidate who's going to be maybe they're inauthentic, but if you can make them do what you want them to do, what's the difference?
Candidates are more likely to get behind you once all political change happens from the grassroots. Power isn't going to give up power unless it's pushed to. And a lot of people, as Michael said, on our side of politics, and it's not just the progressive, it's the liberals, it's the conservative Democrats, we need our votes to be earned, where on the other side, the Republican voters will normally vote for something just as simple as the Supreme Court nominee. Like, I know conservatives who absolutely could not stand Donald Trump, but voted Republican just for that Supreme Court nomination. So I would say the two wings of the party need to come together, work together. We have common issues, and we have areas where we need to work together to work where we can and then disagree where we do. But we can't split the party over this.
Michael, we turn to you. You've been watching politics a long time, probably as long as I have. And you certainly remember the new Democrat right? The Democratic Leadership Council and so on, which was a shift out from, say, Mondale and sort of the traditional labor special interests, as it were, in terms of education folks and so on. Give us a sense about where you think we are with the emergence of somebody like Bernie Sanders as part of a movement.
Well, I think, again, it is important to anchor our present situation in the 1980s with the Reagan victory in 1980 and then again in 84 where Mondale gets just demolished. The elites within the Democratic Party made a strategic decision. They said the money is with the upper middle class and the upper class. We cannot afford for it to survive. At that point, the competition was, I mean, people were talking about the emerging Republican majority, that the Republican Party was going to become the majority party in the country. The Democrats were come to small minority. That was really the kind of angst that was going on. So you had the elite within the Democratic Party deciding, we got to go, we got to finance our party. And they made a strategic shift away from the Jesse Jackson wing that was really the working class traditional direction of the New Deal, Roosevelt kind of orientation, to a Republican light perspective. And what's ironic, of course, is that it was Bill Clinton who helped set that course. And Bill Clinton lays the foundation for Hillary Clinton's loss, because what we have is Hillary Clinton has been on the same track, essentially the corporate liberal, going after the same money that the Republicans have been going after, and the orientation changed from really attending to the interests and the needs of the working class, which, of course, is both white and African-American and Latino-American, and that's what leads partly to her loss. The challenge for progressives now is can you really change the Democratic Party to go back to its roots? And so the clash, I mean, I think the real tension between the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren wing, which I think is a resurrection, in effect, of the New Deal orientation, working class orientation, and essentially the Clinton and the Schumer, Schumer and even some rising stars like New Jersey Senator Cory Booker. If you look at his politics, on the one hand, quite progressive on all kinds of social issues, but he is genuinely a corporate liberal. When push comes to shove, you know, he's very friendly with those interests. And in order for the progressive policies to be addressed, like single payer, right, $15 an hour wage, there's going to have to be, I mean, that is going to be difficult. That's going to be the difficult dynamic to engage.
Well, so what do you make of the fact that we had the former Labor Secretary, Tom Perez, who obviously won the chairmanship, but he's brought on, obviously, Keith Ellison, who seemed to be the more progressive of the two. Is that marriage going to work?
Time will tell, because part of the, I mean, clearly, I think at this point, the progressives have an opening that they did not have previously, which, I mean, it's ironic in one sense, because I do sympathize with my colleagues who just spoke with regard to Hillary Clinton, would she have been better to work with than Donald Trump? No question about it. And on the other hand, the Trump victory is this the shining exhibit A of a corporate win, and so the progressives now have an option to really change the dynamic here. I mean, with regards for healthcare, for example, I mean, Democrats do have an opening here. What do they sell to those constituencies that they think can be addressed now that may be vulnerable in these Republican districts? Do they simply sell, you know, just let's repair Obamacare? Or do they try to sell, this is the opportunity to get rid of all this all these conditions and the like, pre-existing conditions, let's just have single payer. Single payer eliminates the whole question, the whole debate over pre-existing conditions. The only pre-existing condition you need is to be a citizen. Yeah, I mean, so that kind of stark clarity, I think, of issues now is an option for progressives. But who knows? Because you have just one other real quick observation on that point. Conyers, of course, in the House of Representatives, has offered such a bill, and apparently there are some 104 signatures. So there are already 104 members of the House of Representatives willing to stick their necks out for a single payer. Bernie Sanders, on the other hand, said he was going to offer, right? But he now is not going to float a bill, right? Ralph Nader, which I consider one of the more important progressives we have in this country, is now criticizing Sanders and saying, why not, Bernie? What are you doing? Why are you holding back? Why is he holding back? He doesn't want to divide the Democratic Party. What that means is that the tilt back towards the so-called moderate, which I would call the corporate liberal segment, really is getting Bernie to come over to their side for the present time, right? So that's the tussle.
Well, Michael, so what about that, this idea that Sanders, as you just moments ago, on certain issues, but this particular issue, has decided, well, maybe not. Now, he's an elected official, so, you know, he's been involved with politics. I don't know exactly what might make him do that in his own state, but nonetheless, it seems as if there's this fractionalization. I mean, because one of the things, by the way, that apparently Sanders was not a big fan of Ossoff in the Georgia runoff election, or the general election before they go to the runoff. And somebody said, well, yeah, this is crazy. What are we getting? Are progressives and Democrats getting a little too, how many angels on the head of a pin kind of thing? I mean, are we getting, what sense do you get about that?
I mean, I would definitely say that some issues are more important than others. As far as the hesitation to John Ossoff, I think this is a lot more than just about Bernie Sanders or particular politicians in the House or the Senate. This is really about everybody that identifies as progressive or thinks that healthcare should be a human right, all coming together and, like you said, pushing our legislators to act, especially because some of our legislators who are already on board with this type of legislation but may not have dropped something themselves, a la Bernie Sanders, really need that grassroots support to be able to embolden them to do things like pushing for single payer.
Now, as a progressive caucus, you're trying to reach out to voters. And one of the big, at least conventional pieces of wisdom out of the election was that Democrats have not been able to persuade white working class voters to vote Democratic. They decided to vote for Trump instead, as an example. How, particularly somebody who's out there trying to recruit people to your cause, particularly in an area like this, it's very conservative, but still a working class. What is that approach that you're trying to take?
Really, the best success I think that we've had with that so far is, I think that people always assume that progressives and liberals and Democrats, conservatives, pretty much everyone have such differing ideology. But I'll tell you, with the vast majority of the conservatives that I've talked to, while we may disagree on social policy and certain social issues, I think a lot of people would be very surprised how much we agree on economic policy, tax reform, making sure that the upper or the billionaire class pays their fair share in taxes. I mean, when you look at the state of our infrastructure, the state of our health care, and all these other social issues that we may disagree on, the overarching commonality that you'll see between them is that generally it is the working class in general, white or not, versus the billionaire or the corporate class.
So what do you think appealed to these voters when it came to Donald Trump?
I mean, I think you saw it in this last election, especially with all the voters that voted for Obama and then voted for Trump. They voted for Obama back because they wanted to see change. And I think that he was a very charismatic individual and he was very good at selling that dream. But for a lot of people, even after we came out of the recession in 2008, a lot of people still haven't come out of that themselves. The economy has as a whole, but a lot of people are stuck in that mode of still living paycheck to paycheck. And I think what you're seeing now is a coalescing of those people together around these particular issues. And I think that that is not a divide between liberal or conservative. That's something that I think that the 99% is really can get behind.
I mean, is there any particular issue that or set of issues that you try to reach out to somebody who might be a conservative here on the shore?
I mean, really, the main thing that I'll normally use, like I said, is either tax or economic policy. Specifically getting the rich to pay their fair share, or the corruption that we see in our politics, all of the dark money that we see in our politics. One of the reasons that candidates have such a hard time, and one of the things that we're going to need to work on moving forward is funding these candidates, because we are not yet at a point where you have public financing of elections. And I can tell you, after starting to look into exactly how campaigns work and the kind of money that is needed to run them, I mean, that's a huge barrier for anyone that doesn't have the time off to or the funds to take off from their job for the next 18 months.
So Jared, is there a way to overcome the money? I mean, I remember there was a matter of fact, in one of the election campaigns and a number of campaigns actually here on the congressional level, I remember television ads being run. It would now, obviously, it's not an expensive market, but nonetheless, they cost money. And brochures and mailers and so on and so forth, that those seem to have an effect. How do you put that in relationship to what the kind of resources you have and the kind of organizing you think you need to do?
Your question's more along of the caucus standpoint. So basically what the caucus is trying to do is we're reaching out to the candidates, working with them, to be with them along every step of the way. We've worked with bigger progressive groups like Revolution, Progressive Maryland, and other groups from around the state and area about helping to bring people in, to get them the resources, to get them the volunteers, whether that be donors, phone bankers, door knockers. And can I touch on your last point a little bit?
Sure.
On the Democrats not appealing to the white working class? Well, under the corporate wing of the party, we really didn't have anything to say to the white working class. I mean, the Democrats didn't go in and try and talk to them. You can't win over a group of people that you don't even put any effort into. And what brings up progressive politics is whether you be Latino, African-American, white working class, if you're in the working class, these economic issues like a livable wage, access to health care, access to education, economic, environmental, and social justice, that's something that a lot of us agree on. That's whether you're conservative, liberal, moderate, whatever you want to call yourself, that we all agree on. So the progressive politics can get everyone on one side of the table, and that's why you see Bernie Sanders getting disgruntled Republicans, getting a large block of independents, getting the Democrats to his party. And what we would like to do on that here in the caucus is same thing, get everyone on one side of the table and appeal to them. Like, we believe that everyone should have access to education. We believe that people should have access to health care. We believe people should have a living wage, and that's something a lot of people agree on. So from the standpoint of getting what we need to run state elections is to work with other groups to go to these people and say, this is what our platform is. This is why you should get behind it. So if you can donate the time, the money, get behind us, and we can work for you. The progressive wing isn't just because we've stemmed out of the New Deal Democrats, the ones who got America out of the Great Depression, is people are going to start to realize the progressive movement is on your side. It's been on your side. So I feel like that's why we can get other groups and the resources needed. Because if you look at the presidential election, Clinton struggled to get grassroots donors. Why? Because she doesn't represent grassroots donors. When you look at Senator Sanders' campaign, who represented the working class, look how much grassroots donation he got. It was the soul blood of his entire campaign, making $27 an hour. So if you represent the people will take care of your fundraising. They will call for you. They will knock doors for you. And that's what it's all about, and that's what the Democratic Party needs to get back to, representing the working class. We've lost 1,000 seats in 8 years. The Republicans control state majorities, House majority, Senate majority, President, Supreme Court. The Democratic Party needs to understand that the same old politics that worked under Clinton isn't going to work anymore. People have woken up. People want to be represented again, and people want change. So if we go back to that, we won't have problems with getting donors. We won't have problems with getting volunteers. We won't have problems in winning a lot of these races that we've lost.
Michael Philpin?
Yeah, I mean, that's really what it boils down to. When you talk about how to get the funding to pay for all these races, you know, we talk about this issue with money in politics all the time. And I think one thing that we as progressives have been grappling with is, at the end of the day, if you believe in these candidates and you want them to win, we do have to fight back against that money. And we do also have to do that by donating to campaigns. I mean, for example, we do already have a couple candidates that we're looking at for smaller offices, school board, Democratic Central Committee, things like that. But we've actually also already had a progressive candidate for the first district against Andy Harris, Allison Galbraith, that just filed her candidacy a few weeks ago. And one of the things that we're going to have to do moving forward is spending that time, that energy, and that money in order to help pay for these things. Because there are approximately 200,000 doors that our congressional candidate would have to knock in order to flip the voters that she needs to flip. We all know that that's physically impossible, so there has to be the funding there to hire the staff to get this done.
Michael, I'm going to turn to you for a moment, because we've been talking about the white working class. Was one of the mistakes made, maybe it was tone as opposed to anything else, that there was a lot of effort to get out the Hispanic vote, a lot of effort to get out the African-American vote, Asian vote, lots of folks, those kinds of things, and at least conventional wisdom says not enough effort to get out the white working class vote. What role is race playing in all of this? I mean, is it that Democrats made a mistake, or is it some natural outgrowth from obviously what the Republicans have done over the years in terms of wooing certainly the white vote?
I think it seems to me it's undeniable that racism, the racial divide, continues to plague our politics. So that the challenge for progressives is to talk to white working class voters and tell them and help explore the reality that their interest is the same interest as the African American working class and Latino working class. There remains, I think, clearly the a prejudice against the immigrant, against African Americans from the white working class. So that remains. I mean, Trump wins because he appeals not only to the plight of the working class to raise them. I mean, he gives them all false promises. But he appeals to the prejudices, too, to the bigotry, to the racism, and that has a continuing reality. So I think that remains the challenge. I mean, so and that's a difficult problem. It's taken some generations, as Obama has explained. You know, we've made a lot of progress, but we have more progress to make. The younger generation, I mean, I think here's where perhaps the millennial generation, your generation, yeah, has a much greater chance, I think, at breaking that knot, at resolving that issue. I think our generation, even though we come from the 60s, where we were supposed to have put aside all of that, particularly for the working class, for the white working class, I think that remains an issue. Because this was an issue, we have to remember, in the labor movement, all the way in the early part of the 20th century, up through the 30s and 40s, that racial divide clearly was there as well.
As a matter of fact, when I look back at least the baby boom kind of occupancy of the White House, I see certainly Bill Clinton, who represented certainly the more liberal dimension of the 1960s. But then I also see George W. Bush, who really represents the conservative side of that same generation. Well, Michael Feldman, I want to turn to you. What about your generation? I mean, do you see changes occurring? Do you think that's from what you're experiencing, what you're reading, that they are as conservative as, say, for instance, the baby boom generation was, for example? I mean, what are there opportunities there for you? Or
I mean, I would say that the younger generation as a whole happens to be pretty progressive. I think it was about 75% of people under the age of 35 voted for Senator Sanders. So those more progressive ideals, I think, are a lot more popular than a lot of people are giving them credit for. I mean, if you look at the polling for single payer, if you look at the polling for free college tuition for all, if you look at these ideas, it sounds like something that would be such a radical idea, as Senator Sanders often likes to say. But the approval ratings are above 50% and well above 50% in almost all of those polls. So I think that we need to bridge the gap between this idea that these ideas are radical and they can't work in this country and we can't pay for them, and begin to understand that this is what the vast majority of the American people want. And once we get to that, then we as the American people need to show, and as you mentioned earlier, push our legislators or empower our legislators to pass that legislation or hold them accountable in 2018.
What about you, Jared? How do you read your generation?
A lot of what Michael's saying, my generation, and I'm glad to see this, a lot of my generation from learning from like the 60s and the older generations of civil rights, if you ask someone in my generation, like, what do you think about gay marriage, they're going to be like, it doesn't matter. If someone is LGBT, they should have every rights as me. We don't focus on skin color, gender, or sexual orientation. Like, we're a lot more tolerant generation, and we definitely, and as a whole, of course, you do have small minorities of our generation who still have those racist views, but the majority is a lot more tolerant. And as Michael said, my generation is very to the left with Senator Sanders, because Senator Sanders has won always. You can look at anything he said over the last 40 years, and it'd be the exact same thing he's saying now. When you listen to Senator Sanders or a lot of the progressives speak, you know that they're on your side. And that was one of the problems with Hillary Clinton appealing to my generation. During one of the debates, she was like, well, I'm not for college, tuition-free college. And then she comes on and goes and supports it, which is great. But people still remember, you weren't originally with us. You weren't originally with the LGBT community. You had to be pushed. This is something that you shouldn't have to be pushed. You shouldn't have to be told that gay marriage is okay, from my generation's standpoint. And, of course, that differs. To discuss about the baby boomer ideology, and a lot of what the Republicans have done is instill fear in people. The immigrants are taking your jobs. They're pitting each other. They're doing divide and conquer. They're pitting us against each other, which is exactly how they take power. That's exactly why you see the wealthy not paying their fair share in taxes, because it's a lot easier for me as a billionaire to get away with not paying taxes if I'm pitting you against you and you against me and you against each other. So what we need to do is break the narrative and explain to people the immigrant community is not taking your job. And if a lot of the jobs immigrants are taking, a lot of Americans don't work. We saw a piece about the Kentucky Derby, how he said, I'm struggling to find Americans to work these jobs. And the issue brought forth with immigration taking jobs is they're not coming here and stealing jobs. Employers are hiring them because they can pay them less.
And we're running out of time here, so we're going to re-identify everybody. Actually, a good place to stop, because that's where we began. We, of course, have Mike Feldman. He's chair of the Lower Shore Progressive Caucus. Also, Jared Sublime. He's chair of Candidate Recruitment, Education, and Training Committee, as well as, of course, Professor Michael Laughlin, political science professor here at Salisbury University. Appreciate you all stopping by and having this chat this morning.
Thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.